case, Kovacs versus, or In Re, Kovacs. Another bankruptcy. Mr. Fraser?
This case is about the government's violation of the discharge injunction and its efforts to avoid accountability for that error.
But actually, this case is about whether you filed this case in time. Right.
That's
now,
the threshold issue, Your Honor, correct.
Which is a dispositive issue if the answer is no.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So maybe we should just go straight to the timeliness, because I have to say I was a bit taken aback at the idea that a lawyer would take the position that just because the IRS said something must mean that the IRS is right, when this person has had a bankruptcy proceeding, has had a discharge, and now the IRS is coming along to collect something. It seems to me that you can see what the injury is, you can see who's doing it, you've got a good faith reason to think that there's a problem, and you've got 2 years, and I guess I'm focusing on this July 8, 2002 date, you've got 2 years to look into it. How can you not file within that two-year period?
Let me try to address that, Your Honor. It was not clear until the government released to Kovacs its internal position that she was legally injured or that she had a cause of action.
But the government doesn't usually tell people they have a cause of action. People bring lawsuits every day where they haven't had a chance to conduct discovery yet, but they've got a good faith and well, you know, think of Rule 11, you know, good faith and well-supported belief that there's been an injury.
That's right. The question is, did that occur here?
And why isn't the sending of the letters of intent to levy the latest possible critical moment?
Because when the question arose and Kovacs hired an attorney to investigate the matter, the attorneys investigated the matter. The attorneys contacted the IRS. The attorneys contacted the bankruptcy attorney. The attorneys did their own research.
Did they look at the discharge and the schedules that she had filed?
Yes, they looked at all that. And
so
the,
you saw that the tax debts were discharged.
Yes, but let me try to explain how this works. Let's back up a step. Kovacs files an offer in compromise. This was the first offer in compromise. Kovacs pays it off in full. Okay, the IRS zeros out the account. The IRS treats
that. When are you talking about?
This was in 1996, Your Honor.
Right, but the bankruptcy is much later. I mean, I just don't see why, if all of this investigation was done, and you can see that as of the date of the discharge in bankruptcy, which is October 10, 2001, I guess, is the actual discharge date. The case is finally closed in 2002. So the case is closed. And then the IRS, out of the blue, you know, suddenly starts thinking that she owes all this tax liability, and they send letters of intent to levy in mid-2002. Why isn't that ample cause, once you see that those tax years have been covered by the discharge, to begin the process of administrative exhaustion, and then within 2 years of that date to file?
Because Kovacs reasonably relied on the dischargeability determination of the insolvency unit, and Kovacs' investigation.
Why is that reasonable reliance?
Let me try to explain. Back to the offer in compromise. The offer in compromise is paid in full. The government, the IRS, zeroes out the liability. It's treated as discharged, canceled, abated. It's gone. The general legal rule is, under such circumstances, the original assessment is treated as extinguished. And the only way that the IRS can start collecting again is to do a new assessment.
But wait a minute. The whole offering compromise was contingent on paying her taxes on time for the next 5 years.
Correct.
And she couldn't do it in 99, so the IRS tells her the whole deal is off. So she's back at that point to the status quo ante. Now, I will say the IRS has Scrooge-like qualities here. I mean, this poor woman was sick and, you know, was clearly a responsible person. She didn't accumulate very many other debts. I mean, there's a lot that's disturbing about this case. But the fact is, I'm just talking about what a person is required to do. You don't have to have absolute legal certainty to have an obligation to move forward on your legal rights.
Well,
and
what
she gets the discharge in bankruptcy for these tax years. She wouldn't have even put them down as a debt if your original thought that the 1996 OIC erases everything was correct. But she correctly puts them down as a debt. She discloses them on her schedules. They're discharged, and then all of a sudden they start to try to levy again. There's nothing reasonable about thinking that the IRS trumps the United States Bankruptcy Court.
There's nothing unreasonable about thinking what, Your Honor?
I think it's unreasonable to think that the Internal Revenue Service takes precedence over the order of a United States Bankruptcy Court.
Well, the question here is whether Kovacs reasonably concluded that the government's position, A, that the taxes were not dischargeable, was a reasonable conclusion to take.
But the bankruptcy court had discharged them nonetheless. Why doesn't that take you into the bankruptcy court, maybe for a clarification of the discharge order?
Because of the 240-day rule. The government...
You can't go back to the bankruptcy court and say, we need an interpretation of what your order from 2001 was?
If that was a reasonable conclusion, then yes. The reasonable conclusion of the taxpayer and her counsel at this point was, in fact,
well,
the taxes
you,
were
right?
not dischargeable.
You were representing her at this point?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And isn't the question when she had knowledge that would lead a reasonable person to investigate that her rights had been infringed?
Well,
if she knew of the discharge and gets this July notice of the levies, why isn't that sufficient to trigger that a reasonable person would start to investigate?
She investigated much earlier than that, Your Honor. She investigated...
So you're saying the statute should have run earlier than that?
Started
to run earlier?
Under the government's position, that would be a logical conclusion, yes. The question here is when the cause of action accrued. The Treasury regulation says the cause of action accrues when a taxpayer has a reasonable opportunity to discover all essential elements of a possible cause of action. Until the government disclosed its internal position, she did not in this case, because she reasonably concluded that the government position A, if I can call it, the position that it later determined was an error, Kovacs reasonably concluded that that position was correct.
Doesn't that internal policy just go to the IRS's collection efforts, not to the legal issue of dischargeability?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because...
Why?
Because
the bankruptcy code is what sets out dischargeability, not an internal IRS policy.
In this case, it is an internal IRS policy because there was and is no law on the subject about what a reinstatement means for purposes of an assessment. That's
and
the
why
critical
isn't
issue.
It just her position that the thing was discharged? If the IRS wants to come in and defend and say, no, it wasn't discharged because we think this was a reassessment and so on and so forth, let them make the argument as a defense. You don't have to anticipate every defense to a lawsuit you file when you file your complaint.
Kovacs discussed the matter with the IRS. Kovacs and her counsel contacted Al Gross, who was a senior IRS person, and the mutual mistake on the parties for 21 months is, in fact, that these taxes were non-dischargeable. That was a reasonable conclusion under the circumstances.
And you never went back to the bankruptcy court and said, why did you issue an erroneous order purporting to discharge taxes that are actually non-dischargeable.
No, the order wasn't erroneous.
Yes, it was. According to you, it was, because the order grants a full discharge, and if you look at page, look at the schedules that are filed in conjunction with the bankruptcy, which are here someplace in the government's appendix. Okay, page 141. Creditors holding unsecured priority claims, the big creditor is the IRS. So the bankruptcy court orders a discharge.
Well, it was a general discharge.
Right, and that means the things that were before the court, of course not claims that nobody disclosed. I mean, there are obviously exceptions to that, but she discloses three debts, and this creditor's holding unsecured priority claims. And that's what's discharged.
Nobody had argued before the bankruptcy court in connection with the 240-day rule or whether a reinstatement of the liability serves to revive the original assessment or serves as a new assessment for purposes of...
Right, and I understand that, but what I'm having trouble with is the bankruptcy court thinks it's issued an order discharging this debt, and if somebody thought that was wrong, they needed to go back to the bankruptcy court. These are essentially courts of equity. They can, in fact, entertain questions like this from time to time.
Kovacs determined that based on her investigation, which was a diligent investigation, that the government position with regard to the dischargeability determination was reasonable and correct.
So maybe she just has to live with that then, because if that's her view, then later developments happen while the 2 years is running.
And later developments did happen.
And they happen while the 2 years are running.
Right. The key, and they certainly did happen while the 2 years was running. The key question is whether Kovacs's cause of action under the Treasury regulation accrued that early or accrued when the government disclosed its internal position on the question.
Didn't her testimony during the trial that she was shocked in July of 2002 when she received the levy notice because she thought the taxes had been discharged? Doesn't that answer the question?
It doesn't,
Your
Honor,
because she knew at that point that she had an injury and she should have proceeded. Doesn't that trigger it?
Put in context, that remark does not make any sense. Kovacs believed she had a possible injury when the IRS started its collection activity again.
How doesn't that make any sense? She thought it was discharged because of the bankruptcy. She got a notice saying, we're going to start levying because it's not discharged. I'm shocked. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Well, no, it doesn't. It shows that Kovacs was confused. She also gave trial testimony.
It actually shows she was right, I have to say, not confused.
Well, it turned out that she was right, but to suggest that the record would support a finding that she knew that the government was violating the discharge injunction at that point is something that just doesn't make sense. Recall, she had been told repeatedly for months, for 21 months, by the IRS and by her attorneys, that the subject taxes were not subject to discharge.
But under the standard, she doesn't have to necessarily know at that point. She just has to be put on notice to start a reasonable investigation. Why isn't that enough to put her on notice?
Because she didn't know the government's internal position on the point. That's why it didn't put her on notice. It was one in a series of many harms that had, at that point, no particular significance or distinguishing features from the other harms she experienced before and after.
But again, why doesn't that internal policy just go to collection efforts, not dischargeability, not the legal question, the legal injury?
Well, it goes to both because the assessment date triggers the running of limitations for collection. It also triggers the limitation for when you start to count the 240-day rule for purposes of dischargeability.
All right. Ms. Fraser, you want to save some time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sheehan?
May it please the Court, I'm Anthony Sheehan, and I represent the United States.
All right, so Mr. Sheehan, I have a question for you that we didn't get into with Mr. Fraser. Putting to one side all this business about internal IRS positions about this or about that, we move up to 2003, and in particular, we move up to this letter that's issued on September 8th, 2003, after the Mulcahy mea culpa has come through. And this letter pertains to tax year 1990. It's very clear at the top of the letter. And it tells her, correct balance due IRS, $13,122.43. Nothing on the first page about you don't really have to pay this. It just says, here's a tear-off stub. Then the second page is this long list of how interest has accrued. And then the third page has some boilerplate that, in context, looks like it thinks that there's a pending bankruptcy case. We've been notified that a petition of bankruptcy has been filed by or against you. Our records indicate there's a balance due in your income tax. We may file a proof of claim. This all makes no sense in the context of Kovacs's position. And so I want to know why, and then, you know, you wind up with this, you know, amount you owe, $13,000. Why doesn't this letter trigger a new period of 2 years? It's a new effort to collect on a discharged debt.
Well, I would first of all have to say, agree with you that context is important. And we did have the Mulcahy letter, which said, you don't know this anymore. We're going to have to start adjusting your account.
So she's a layperson. What's she supposed to believe? She gets this thing dated September 8th, 2003, mm-hmm. as I say, very clearly marked for tax period December 31, 1990, it says. So there's no mm-hmm. way a rational person could think this pertains to her 1999 tax year, which we all fully understand right. was not mm-hmm. discharged. That's not what this letter is about. The IRS is very particular about each tax year being its own
correct.
Separate event. And so I don't see why, as a rational person, with this back and forth and back and forth that the IRS has gone through, this letter doesn't trigger a new period. And she then, of course, files an administrative claim well within that new period. She's in time if this letter
if that
works.
Letter. Let's see, go back a couple steps, though. First of all, the Mulcahy letter said we're going to have to adjust your account. And all the September 8th, 2003 document shows is an account adjustment. I think we even admitted in our brief it is not artfully worded. It's
well,
full of IRS boilerplate.
It's worse than that. It says, we found credits erroneously applied to your account in the amount of $149. Balance due on account before adjustment, zero, less erroneous credits. Mm-hmm. and so forth, then other charges. And the bottom line says, correct balance due IRS. I'm looking at your appendix. This is supplemental appendix 168-170. And I am just very concerned that dancing around, you know, inartful wording is quite unfair to people. There's not a hint in this letter mm-hmm. that there's a pending dispute. There's not a hint that we don't really want the money right now. The only language about bankruptcy seems to be pertinent to people who have filed a petition in the 362 stays, in effect.
Well, what this notice is actually doing, it's moving money erroneously put in a settlement year out of the settlement year to put it in a year where it properly can be collected. It is not, in fact, as confusing as it may be.
That's not what it tells her. It says, if you haven't paid, it's please pay mm-hmm. the full amount by September 18, 2003.
I would also point out a couple of other things. There's some testimony in the record that Ms. Kovacs and her counsel understood that this is what is going on. Also, I think that if...
I'm not sure Ms. Kovacs or her counsel understood much about what the IRS was doing, actually.
Secondly, I would say that if the court were to consider this to technically be a violation, I believe the district court got it right when it put it into the category of continuing injury.
I don't think that's right at all, actually, because the IRS issues notices of levy. Maybe the underlying reasons were still that there was a 1990 tax year for which full payment had not been made. Everybody agrees with that. Right. I mean, the only question is whether it's forgiven or not. She didn't pay. I assume it's such a huge number because of interest and penalties.
Probably, yes.
That's usually the case.
And thirdly, if you disagree with the district court, this would best fit within the category of a discrete new violation, and a remand would be necessary to determine the damages attributable just to this document. We would submit it does not fit within the category that Ms. Kovacs would like to put it in of an ongoing injury like a hostile workplace environment where she can use this to reach all the way back to the beginning.
Well, that may be correct. I mean, as I see it, it is its own violation, and thus whatever remedies would have to go along with it would
have to be a remand to determine how what's attributable. And given that the IRS, even if this is treated as a collection action, we continue to respectfully dispute that. It would have to go back to figure out what happened here. And since there was nothing came of this, maybe Mr. Graw, Mr. Fraser's associate, wrote some letters. Would have to go back and figure out what hours would be attributable just to this. And it certainly would not be well below the $25,000 originally awarded in the case in chief. Just to respond to a couple of things that happened on the opening argument.
Before you do that,
yes.
Mr. Shan, I have a question. The bankruptcy court initially analyzed this under sections 105A and 524.
Yes.
Is there a willfulness element to section 524? Because section 7433 and 7430 apply to give the exclusive jurisdiction to willful violations. So could 524 proceed on a non-willful violation?
You are correct that 7433E deals with willful violations. Willfulness in this context.
And I know the IRS has conceded that here, but could she have proceeded below on 524 on a non-willfulness argument? Or is that an element? I don't see it written in the statute, but is that an element of 524?
Because 7433 is exclusive, and we've conceded willfulness.
But it's exclusive for willfulness.
Right. I'd have to go back and read 524. I would say that willfulness in this context is not implying bad actor or bad motive. It's the IRS somewhere institutionally has found out that there's a discharge, and it acts anyway, even if the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing.
And I'm not arguing or suggesting that it's something along the lines that you're suggesting. I'm just wondering if there's a distinction between 524 and 7430 and 7433 where she could have proceeded on a non-willful violation under 524.
I would say it might be theoretically possible. I'd have to go back and reread 524. But the standard for willfulness is so low here that it's very hard to imagine a case where you would not find willfulness.
But if willfulness is not an element of 524, could she have proceeded against that, against the IRS under 524?
Then I have to read it, but theoretically, yes, if it's not an element. If what you're saying is correct, if it's not an element, she probably could have proceeded.
Because then the two-year statute of limitations wouldn't apply.
That would be correct, yes.
But
again, willfulness here was conceded.
I understand, agree.
Okay. Going back, the regulation talks about a reasonable opportunity to discover the elements, and Ms. Kovacs and her counsel have made this argument about secret law. I just want to point out that there is no secret law here. Ms. Kovacs herself, as a layperson, properly spotted that there's something funny going on. She sought the assistance of counsel.
Could I just finish up with one thought?
Yes.
Following up on what Judge Saini was just saying. So it's your position that if the IRS concedes willfulness, then it can buy for itself an automatic two-year statute of limitations and foreclose a longer period?
What I'm saying here is that in this case, there is clear evidence that it was willful as willfulness
right, but
works
suppose,
here.
Suppose that it was just negligent. You're saying there's a longer statute that applies.
If you got to the point where it was just negligent,
maybe other things aren't recoverable then.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's sort of odd the way Congress drafted this statute. I think Congress thought they were trying to make it the exclusive remedy, period, but they did put in the willfulness language, which certainly exists here. When the IRS was told by Ms. Kovacs in her letter of March 5th, 2002, I got a discharge, when Mr. Graw, Mr. Frazier's associate, sends in the discharge document in the letter of May 23rd, 2002.
But if it exists, that's an extra element to prove if you pursue that remedy. If it doesn't, if it exists and you don't want to pursue that remedy, you don't have to prove it.
I would say if the Congress intended, not just intended, Congress did make this the exclusive remedy for willful violations, there's willfulness here.
And I agree with you that it appears to be the exclusive remedy for willful violations.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't want to pursue a willful violation, if you don't want to prove that extra element of willfulness, can't you still proceed under 524?
The problem is that it would effectively gut the statute because any, you know, it would make 7433E a dead letter because any taxpayer who's blown the statute would simply come in and say, it was a mistake. Even if I handed the discharge to the person and he handed me a collection document, I'm just not going to push willfulness. I'll go under negligence and get my damages that way.
Are there additional
different damages?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, there was a time before there was a 7433.
Right.
So, I mean, in other words, there may be a price on the other side of not using 7433.
Well, the problem is that
what damages did people get in the pre 7433?
It was up. It was the scheme before that. You'd go under. 106 is the waiver of sovereign immunity. 105 is the cause of action empowering the bankruptcy court, and it was ever the bank what the bankruptcy court thought was appropriate. It was a contempt power essentially.
So it could have essentially just issued an injunction to the IRS saying cut it out, stop bothering this woman.
They could have just done it that way, or make sure you straighten out the person's account and here's a little money for your time. But it was up to the bankruptcy court before that. So. Again, we go back to reasonable opportunity. Here, there was no secret law. The issue was spotted. Mr. Frazier and Mr. Graw discussed among themselves, was this a reassessment or was this a reinstatement? And with that knowledge, there are plenty of things to do. Did they contact her bankruptcy attorney? Yes, they were in contact with Mr. Schumann, but only to obtain documents. They didn't ask, well, what do you think? Was this discharged?
Where's that in the record? Did he file an affidavit to that effect that no one ever asked him?
That would be Mr. Graw's testimony, I believe, at page 106 and 107 of the supplemental appendix. He says the testimony certainly is cited in our brief, and I'm just going.
He says the discussion with him was for request of documents.
For a request of documents, but there's nothing to indicate.
So he never testifies affirmatively that there's a more substantive discussion. I don't know. I'll have to look at it. Yeah. I can't remember his disclaimer.
But certainly at this point you can get a transcript. You could see if it's if there's an assessment, it'll be on the transcript. It'll say tax assessed. You can call up the insolvency unit. I mean, I've been representing the IRS for 17 years now as my client. And I don't take their word for anything. I always check it out.
You're on the record, by the way.
What?
You're on the record, by the way.
And I know these are being recorded and my bosses can hear it. But you can call the insolvency unit. The bankruptcy, this discharge was in the background, but there's no indication in this record that, you know, the insolvency unit or anybody was contacted and was affirmatively pushed. What's going on here? Explain this to me. Why are you still collecting from my client? This should have been discharged. The reasonable opportunity to discover was there. It was there at the latest by July 8th, 2002, notwithstanding our prior discussion, Your Honor. And we believe that the dismissal of this case should be affirmed.
No further.
Mr. Fraser?
If I may jump back into the question of what the transcript revealed in this case. The transcript is part of the record. This is the only document that is available to a taxpayer or a taxpayer's counsel with regard to the postings of the IRS in this case. The transcript reveals in this case that the original assessment had been discharged. It was gone. Okay, there is also a notation in the transcript that the collateral conditions of the offer and compromise had been satisfied. A reasonable person would conclude from that that what is required to begin the collection process again was a new assessment. That didn't take place here. What took place is a reinstatement of the liability.
Which actually happens to be the word that was used in the letter, as I recall. The letter said we're reinstating or reinstituting or something.
Reinstatement is the term of art.
But my recollection is the letter actually said we're reinstituting.
No, the letter, Your Honor, says we're reinstating the liability. There's no law concerning.
It didn't say we're reassessing.
No, we are reinstating the liability. And then they start to collect. Well, how is that possible without a reassessment? It's possible, I submit, under contract law or maybe under the IRS's internal administrative postings. Okay, but if they can start collecting after a reinstatement, okay, and treating that as a new assessment, it stands to reason that the IRS should be treating that reinstatement as a new assessment for the purposes of the 240-day rule. That follows one after the other.
Mr. Fraser, I know your time is up, but real quickly, what's your position on whether or not there's a willfulness requirement under Section 524?
Well, when you say Section 524, let's break that question.
Through 105.
Through 105?
Which is how you originally proceeded.
Well, I'm not sure there is a willfulness requirement through 105. And actually, that leads to my last point is that 7433 is not an exclusive remedy, and the bankruptcy court was fully within its power to sanction the government for violation of the discharge injunction under Section 105 and 106. Mr. Sheehan is quite correct that under 7433, the threshold for willfulness is very, very low, and the government conceded the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Fraser. Thank you, Mr. Sheehan. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the fourth case.